Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR, and I'm Mark Bayshore. Later on this hour, the East Lansing-based creators of an online language learning game. Learn about Zahn from the guy that created it and another fellow from an organization called Spartan Innovations. They are involved in spinning off on-campus enterprises out into the larger world for commercialization. It's a very interesting process, and we will get with that here in just a little bit. Coming up on Current State, we're glad you're along here today. At the beginning of the academic semester this fall, a Michigan State University professor became the focus of controversy over a video recorded in his classroom. English professor William Penn's remarks on Republicans went viral. "We apologize for the quality of what you're about to hear, but you should be able to make this out." This was one comment in which he considers Republicans to be cheap.
"Be forewarned, I'm eccentric. I hate bureaucracy. I will say what I think. I in no way mean to offend you. If I do, I said it. Come up, tell me. I will apologize. And I absolutely don't mean to offend you. Even if you are a Republican, I don't mean to offend you in this class. Outside of class is a different matter. Okay?"
Okay, there was Professor William Penn. Elsewhere in his presentation on the first day of classes, he said he mentioned that Republicans don't want to pay taxes because they've already raped this country. And other remarks, he suggested that Republicans are closet racists who want to prevent black people from voting because they tend to vote for Democrats. Now, one result of the criticism over the video was a decision that Penn would not teach this semester. The incident has brought attention to the issue of academic freedom and freedom of speech. Now, a committee's been formed to further look into MSU's handling of the Penn affair. Communication Professor William Donahue is chairing the Committee on Social Media, Pedagogy, and Academic Rights and Responsibilities. Welcome, Professor Donahue.
Thank you very much.
And Penny Gardner is an assistant professor in the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures. She also serves on the committee. Hi, Penny.
Hello.
Bill Donahue, let's start with you. What has this committee exactly been asked to do?
We've been asked to explore the extent to which students and faculty and others have sort of social media rights in the classroom. So when a professor says something in the classroom, do students have the right to record and upload anything that goes on in class? Does the faculty member have the right to prohibit students from recording what goes on in class and uploading that to some social media site? The current policy on social media use at MSU, which our committee, the University Committee on Faculty Affairs, crafted last spring, doesn't mention these kinds of rights and responsibilities. The policy, which is about 7 pages long, it's fairly extensive, just talks about sort of responsible use by faculty members and students related to
not specific enough then, really?
No.
Okay. You're both experienced professors at Michigan State. Has a student ever tried to videotape one of your lectures, Penny?
No, but I will tell you that the incident is chilling for me as a fixed-term faculty that gets hired semester by semester, that a tenure-track faculty, although I do believe perhaps his rant, as it's been called, was inappropriate, but in thinking of academic freedom and job security, I am concerned about who I am as a person, as an old person, as a leader in the LGBT movement, and how I could be recorded and passed on to someone and then have the university say, ooh, she's trouble. Let's not have her. So I think that's a piece of the academic freedom that was scary to me as that tenured faculty being removed from his class as a distinguished faculty member that has had, is from a minority population, has diversity, is published, and has earned something. I do believe we do have to be appropriate in the classroom, although I come out as a lesbian on the very first day of class. Could that be recorded and used somewhere?
Well, Bill Donahue, are you confident that, that academic freedom and transparency can coexist here? And is that the end game here, really?
Yes. I think it's important to point out that the university didn't remove William Penn from the classroom. He met with folks at MSU, and they sort of discussed how would you like to go from here, given the media frenzy associated with this particular issue. What would you like to do? And he sort of decided that what he would like to do is remove himself from the classroom for the semester because he didn't want the exposure. He was never asked to leave. He was never told that he should leave. He made a joint decision with the administration to reassign him to other duties for the semester. I share Penny's concern. I mean, just when somebody says something and it gets a reaction, you know, how is it handled and treated? But in this particular case, it's clear from remarks that administration's made to my committee that they were not going to remove anybody for what they say in class, particularly in this particular instance.
Well, had he not decided to drop out, though, do you think the administration would have taken some kind of action?
No. I don't think they would have said, based on your comments, you can't teach her anymore.
Really?
I don't think they would have done that. MSU, in my experience, has supported people to express themselves in class. I mean, here's a, as Penny points out, a distinguished faculty member.
Had he stayed in the classroom, it's not hard to assume that there would have been some percentage of the public who would have been very upset about that, though. So that,
and that's the piece, that that part of academic freedom is that the pressure from outside should not dictate what goes on in the classroom.
Even at a publicly funded university?
Even at a publicly funded university,
this is what
I
a
believe.
Lot of people can't, this is
right.
what a lot of people yeah. can't get past.
It's not, yeah, but it in terms of academic freedom, which is a policy that was written back in 1915 by the American Association of University Professors or something like that. I kind of went back and was looking at that. That it can't be, the pressures from outside can't be forced on a professor speaking in terms of their discipline and what they're doing. And I also would question whether Penn leaving the classroom was the best thing. It might be that it could have been a very wonderful and rich dissent and conversation and learning for the students and for the professor and for the university. And that's all. And there's another story that I think that's been said about whether, I never heard that he agreed to leave, but maybe that wasn't made public.
No, it the media reports, I think, sort of slanted it, indicating that he was removed.
Okay.
And he was not removed. He volunteered in a joint decision-making process to reassign himself because he was afraid the media circus could have a negative impact. So it's a very interesting issue. I mean, I study hate speech as part of what I do academically. Mm-hmm. And certainly if a professor gets up and starts ranting in a hate speech kind of way, and was this hate speech? I mean, there's no clear definition of what that is, but if somebody gets up and starts ranting about something that's clearly aimed at disparaging groups of one form or another, how should the administration respond to that? I mean, what's the responsibility? And, you know, there just aren't very clear-cut guidelines about what counts as academic freedom and what counts as hate speech. I mean, this has been a debate that's gone on forever.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what the what the discussions are right now involving Professor Penn and his return to the classroom? Can you shed any light on that?
I don't know if he's coming back next semester to teach or not. I assume he is, but I don't know that for a fact.
Can you generalize? Can you generalize that the larger faculty response to this is similar to Penny's?
Yes, I mean the media. Discussion was that he was removed, and I think that was what most faculty believed to be true, because it was never really corrected. And you know, there have been lots of discussions about those kinds of concerns. I mean, when you're in a classroom and you say something controversial, you know, and it can get uploaded. That's what our committee is mostly concerned about.
Last December, conservative commentator David Horowitz appeared here at Michigan State, and a member of the journalism faculty, Bonnie Buckaroo, a person you probably
know Bonnie, sure.
Videotaped some of Horowitz's comments and posted them onto YouTube. Again, apologies for the slightly muffled audio, but here is how that ended.
Very few people know the full history of the Nazis in Middle East.
By the way, is that a film?
It's video.
Yeah, you should have asked for permission to do that.
This isn't an open meeting?
Not to be videoed.
Oh, I thought you recommended that students should video the professors. You want everything transparent.
Oh, I got some communist here. Well, let's go on. Go ahead.
Could you?
Oh, good. I'm a little further left than that.
Would you identify what some of the basic elements of Sharia are and what they mean to Christians?
You know, I'm gonna have to confiscate this film, and I'm gonna tell you why. I'm gonna tell you exactly why, because people like you filmed me when I was at Brooklyn College, and they extracted a sentence here and a sentence there, and it was all over the internet.
To confiscate?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Well, I'm
end of video. Now, David Horowitz is not a faculty member at Michigan State University. He was here, and I'm quite sure paid to be here by some campus group. My question is this. How can some of the same faculty pursue transparency so vigorously in one circumstance and appear to resist it so vigorously in another set of circumstances? Can we shed any light on that conundrum?
I believe that in academic freedom, Horowitz was absolutely correct, able to be here and to be invited and to be paid. And I believe that in an open meeting, perhaps it can be filmed. I don't believe a classroom is an open meeting. I believe the classroom is a contract between the student and the professor, and the professor has a contract with the university that applies to that has academic freedom in it.
Even at a publicly subsidized university.
I don't know why you keep asking. Because
a lot of people feel that's really at the heart of this.
But they're also, the public is paying for their students or for the citizenry to be educated and to be able to be to descend and to argue and to promote and to do whatever, and that's what we're teaching. We're teaching students to have their own voice, to make their way in this world, either in a job or as a thoughtful person, as a citizen of the United States.
And that requires some provocation from the
right,
part of
I would guess.
We're down to 30 seconds. Bill Donahue, any final comments on this process?
Yes, I want to emphasize that the university shares Penny's passion for students being able to explore their concerns, their interests, their thoughts, their feelings about various issues. And we need to have that kind of open exchange. That's how knowledge grows. That's how we progress as a university. So that's what our committee is going to be looking into.
All right. We'll be keeping track of it. Hopefully we'll have you back. Communications Professor Bill Donahue, chairing the Committee on Social Media, Pedagogy, and Academic Rights and Responsibilities. Penny Gardner, an assistant professor in the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures, is also on the committee. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We have a question for you. Have you ever considered learning all about another country, say China?
您好。
Well, a local electronic game developer may have just the ticket. Ken Durkin is the creator of Zon, an elaborately layered interactive video game.
你好，欢迎来中国。
He created it a few years back with two aims, to prepare young people for the global economy and to create what he calls next-generation electronic language learning. The story of Ken Durkin and Zon also offers an interesting look at how a promising commercial idea evolves in 2013, especially one involving electronic media. Here to talk about Zon and his efforts to make it a success is Ken Durkin, Zon's creator and the president of Zon Labs, LLC. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
As well as Jeff Banker, whose title is Entrepreneur in Residence at Spartan Innovations, which provides various support necessary to turn MSU research technologies into successful businesses. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
An entrepreneur with the last name of Banker sounds very promising indeed.
Banker, that's an engineer.
Ken Durkin, describe what it's like to play Zon in a little bit more detail. What happens?
A user goes in and they create an account. That account then allows them to build an avatar. An avatar is a digital representation of yourself.
Okay.
So you get to skin it, dress it, kind of like a digital doll. Then that becomes your persona in the game. The whole game's narrative is based on being a tourist in China. So very much high-use words that you would get when you show up at the airport. How do you go through customs? How do you get your baggage? How do you exchange money? And then moving on from there, going to a hotel, checking in. At that point, the economy of the game kicks in. You have to eat, you want to go shopping, you want to get better clothes, and that's where the social component also builds.
And who is using Zon today? Who's experiencing this?
It's a wide range of people. It can be anybody, a lot of adult language learners interested in Chinese, but we've had a real pickup in middle school age kids. In the U.S. with language learning, a lot of the language learning that used to be in high school, where it was romance languages like French, Italian, and German, Spanish, has moved into kind of 21st century languages, Chinese, Japanese, Korean. And the idea that these kids in middle school need exposure to that is very important. So a lot of school districts are looking at getting those kids exposed. Plus, they're also the perfect base for language learning in the digital age.
Without a doubt. Jeff Banker, what has explained Spartan Innovations' role in Zon?
Spartan Innovations, Spartan Innovations is a new branch of MSU that ultimately spun out of the Tech Transfer Office. That's sole mission is to nurture entrepreneurship in the university and to support spin-out companies and help companies that want to take technology created here at MSU and create for-profit enterprises and, you know, spring forth into the market.
Okay. Now, Zon has been around for a few years. How has it evolved, Ken, and where are you today in 2013?
Zon started out as a research contract. It was part of a kind of group of grants and contracts that is evolved around the Confucius Institute at Michigan State University and the College of Ed. Zon was developed by the content team from the Confucius Institute, plus a bunch of other people who were game designers, telecommunications, even here at ComArts, all put their touch on it. And then it basically ran for the longest time as a beta. And in 2012, we decided that it needed to move out of the university. The funding in terms of the research contract had ended, and we had a good base of users, and we wanted to move that into a commercial enterprise.
Okay. How does somebody in Ken's situation, Jeff Banker, monetize Zon here? What is the end game from your perspective?
Well, the end game from the Spartan Innovations perspective is we want Ken, we want Zon Labs to be successful in the marketplace. I'm one of four CEOs in residence or entrepreneurs in residence. Our mission, and I'm a part-time resource here, our mission is simply to help the budding entrepreneur understand what the marketplace is all about. How do you raise money? How do you plan for raising money? How do you take products to market? How do you do sales? Typically things that a university staff or a researcher may not have thought about previously. We're simply here to provide that advice and mentoring and guidance to help them along.
I'm still not clear though, Ken. Are you on the road to independence? Is it questionable that you will become a self-sufficient, viable business, or where are you?
It's always questionable if you're going to be a self-sufficient business. So what Spartan Innovations and the MSU Technology Innovations Group has done is allowed us to think about how to make a commercial product. So move out into a company. And that's what we did. We licensed the software from Michigan State University, and at the same time have gotten help from Michigan State University to move out into the private sector. So we're a legitimate company. We have clients, and we're moving forward as quickly as possible.
You've been kicked out of the nest.
Yeah.
You have. Yeah. But you launched a Kickstarter campaign to fund the development of Zahn. Where does that stand?
So Kickstarter is a way to kind of earn money or pledge people who want to subscribe to the service. So what we did is we put out a Kickstarter saying, for $30 a user, you can subscribe to our service and get half price for an annual subscription. That way we get some revenue under our belt so that we can finish the product quicker. We don't have to worry about development timelines as much. We just quickly have deliver the service to the people through their pledges.
What were you first, though? Were you an electronic game developer, or were you a China enthusiast?
Electronic game developer.
Okay.
A product like this, Zahn, is so immense that we have such a wide variety of people who've touched it in the past and as well work on it now. So we have the Chinese language content specialist, we have the game developers, and we have programmers, as well as just user interface designers, marketers, website designers. I mean, you just name it. It's a big endeavor.
Jeff Banker, how many projects are you overseeing right now, or are you involved in? At Spartan Innovations?
Typically, it's about four. I think at this current setting, there's six, actually, I'm doing, of course, a ton of work with Ken here. He's one of the primary projects, but I think up to six projects right now. But typically, it's four or five we're looking at.
Okay. And Ken, you've taken up residence. Well, you've been at the NEO Center in Lansing for a while.
Yeah, we've been at the NEO Center for about a year, and they've been very helpful. We got hooked up there with Tom Stewart and his group, and it's been a wonderful place to be. It's great to be in Lansing. I felt like we needed to be somewhere in Lansing and not, say, right across from MSU. That seemed too close to the nest, as you put it. And so being in Lansing's been great. We got a lot of support from the Lansing Economic Area Partnership with Jeff Smith and Ken Smusiak. They've been great. And so also have gotten help from Ann Arbor Spark out of Ann Arbor, which is a tech transfer and kind of entrepreneurial effort.
Jeff Banker, do you work more with faculty or students or both?
Almost entirely faculty. There's a separate group, if you will, run by Paul Jakes within Spartan Innovations. He's responsible for student outreach. So there's a hatch over there, for example, that is student-led entrepreneurial ideas that they're trying to hatch out of that. That's right on our floor over there. Paul runs that. But the CEOs and residents tend to work more so with experienced staff and professors and researchers and things like that.
There appears to have been an awful lot of momentum generated from the notion of taking a university-based idea and getting it out into the larger world. You've seen this unfold, I take it.
I have. I've been here just over 2 years, I think, and the change in 2 years has been tremendous. We've got, in fact, Spartan Innovations did not exist 2 years ago. I was working in the tech transfer office. Our executive director, Brian Abraham, has just passed his year anniversary. He's putting in place lots of new programs. It's gone from, I would say, being many years behind other universities in the state to maybe just a few years behind, just in a couple of years. It's been tremendous progress.
Ken, is Zahn Labs, do you employ people, or is it a one-man show at this point?
No, we have several people work as co-founders of the company, and some of them for free to cut on costs, but also at the same time, we do have employees, specifically in programming. Programming is a very hard thing to find. There's a lot of competition for it.
There's no shortage of Chinese faculty and students at Michigan State University. What do they make of Zahn?
Well, you know, Zahn was developed in the College of Education. It was kind of a different look at how language instruction should be done, specifically with Chinese, a much more Western approach compared to the Eastern approach, which is memorizing characters and working through kind of the traditional way of learning Chinese. So we took a very Western communicative competency approach. And I think people have responded to it very well. And people really have endorsed the work that's been done at the Confucius Institute at Michigan State University as well, in terms of Chinese teacher training as well, and other services that were done at the Confucius Institute. So overall, I think the initiatives that we've had, including Zahn, have been very well received.
Ken Durkin is the creator of Zahn and the president of Zahn Labs, LLC. We thank him, as well as Jeff Banker, entrepreneur in residence at Spartan Innovations. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Good luck. Ontario Power Generation plans to store 200,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste in an underground cavern. The storage site's location has raised concern across the Great Lakes Basin because of its close proximity to Lake Huron. State Senator Hoon-Young Hopgood traveled to Canada to address the threat the disposal site poses to Michigan. He started out our conversation by explaining why Ontario Power Generation picked the contested location.
The site is on the Bruce Peninsula, and the Bruce Peninsula is home to the largest nuclear power generation facility in the world. They have 8 reactors on site. They obviously produce a substantial amount of nuclear waste. Ontario, as a province, has about 20 reactors that generate nuclear power. And so they generate a lot of waste. Since this is the site of the largest facility, I think they, out of a matter of convenience, are looking to this site to build such a repository.
And why are you concerned? Why are you and other Michiganders concerned about that?
Well, I'm concerned because it is right on Lake Huron. And as you know, waters are connected. Lake Huron is certainly connected to Michigan. And the Great Lakes literally define our state. Our lives and our livelihood depend on our waters, and making sure that we have clean water to drink and to use and everything else really is at the heart of what I think legislators should be concerned about. And so this is certainly something that I feel is important to me personally, but I also think is a charge to my job as a state legislator.
Ontario Power Generation did consult scientists and experts about the site. We should say, remind everybody, this is underground, quite a ways underground. Those reports suggest the limestone in the underground cavern they plan to use for waste storage is impermeable, and that the location's not geologically active. The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission concludes that OPG's plan poses little risk to the public. Are those reports not enough to ease your concern?
Well, certainly. You know, we've heard from geologists who have other points of view. So there is some consensus around the fact that this rock underground may be a good rock. It may be stable. It may, not have been disturbed for a long time. But the fact is, we're doing the disturbing. The actual process of building a repository such as this involves a lot of explosions and a lot of moving of rocks and earth and whatnot. You have to build shafts. You have to build the cavern underground. You have to build monitoring wells and all of that. So what we're actually doing to construct the well, to construct the repository, is probably one of the threats that we would be concerned with going forward. We can't model this stuff. There's nothing in the world that proves that this is safe. So people can suggest that it's safe. People can say that it's not likely to do things, but we've said that before, and we've been wrong as a people and faced the consequences of that.
OPG is currently storing low and intermediate level waste at ground level at this site. Does that concern you as well?
That's a part of the nuclear power industry. So we have reactors all over the world. Most of them are storing some waste on site. Here in Michigan, we have reactors that are doing the same. The concern about the repository, what we're talking about, is burying it underground, monitoring it for some period of time, and then basically forgetting about it. This stuff, the intermediate level waste, stays hot for 100,000 years. And that's basically forever. This issue is bigger than right now in the concerns of today. It really is a long-term issue. And to mitigate the risk, to think about siting this away from 20% of the world's freshwater supply is something that we just think is prudent and wise, and that's what we've asked OPG to do.
We're talking with State Senator Hoon-Young Hopgood about his involvement in plans that Ontario has, the Canadian government has, to bury nuclear waste near the shores of Lake Huron. You attended hearings in Canada last week that involved this. What happened at these hearings?
Well, you know, we traveled over to Kincardine, Ontario. That's up on the Bruce Peninsula. That's very close to the site of the nuclear power facility. And we presented the Michigan story. And I think that that was an important thing to do because the outreach has been abysmal. There has been no public outreach in terms of this project beyond just a small radius in Canada. And so we think that people all around the Great Lakes and out to the St. Lawrence Seaway should be made aware of this. It's a concern for all of us. So we delivered our concerns, the fact that Michigan's lives and livelihoods depend on the Great Lakes, but we also were able to clear up some issues. One issue, a previous person providing testimony had given the impression that this project, this DGR, would be possible under Michigan law. We explained that that's absolutely not the case. We would not allow for underground disposal. We would not allow for long-term above-ground disposal of this type of waste. And so we needed to clear those things up because they were under the impression, because of their lack of outreach, that other people were okay with it. People in Michigan are not okay with it. We passed a resolution in the state Senate. It passed unanimously, expressing concerns regarding this project. We want to protect our Great Lakes. We had 26 other state senators sign on as co-sponsors of that legislation, Democrats, Republicans from all over the state.
Generally, how did people at these hearings respond to your comments?
Well, you know, there's a panel that you're speaking to, and the panelists, I think, really the chair wanted to get at the heart of some of these questions. So when we said there wasn't much outreach, she really wanted to investigate that. There were other questions in terms of Michigan law and not allowing this type of proposal here in the state of Michigan. They wanted to really get at the heart of that. And so I think that they were, it was new information for them. It was valuable for them to hear that. Now, the audience, you had a lot of people who had concerns. You had people, these hearings will go on for more than a month. You have people who spend a considerable amount of time camped out in Kincardine, Ontario, paying attention to these hearings, listening. And what's neat about this process is the public actually has an opportunity to ask some questions of the participants, not just the person who's giving the testimony, but also OPG as well. So it was an interesting process.
Did you get a handle on how the Canadian public feels about the waste deposit site proposal?
We're getting a lot of feedback and a lot of attention. Just on the visit, we had some media attention, so we were in several publications over on the other side. There's some support for the project very locally, and quite frankly, there's financial agreements set up. There's host community agreements which pay some of these local communities to openly support this project. Once you get beyond that radius, support falls way off. Awareness falls way off. Lots of people in Canada are hearing for it for the first time in the last couple of months. Mm. And so, once again, the outreach or lack of outreach just isn't Michigan. It's all over.
After these hearings, what next? What happens?
The joint review panel considers the testimony and weighs everything, and then they make a recommendation on whether to proceed or not to proceed. That recommendation goes to the Canadian cabinet, and then the cabinet makes the final decision. And that could happen in the first couple of months of next year. This is something that we need to weigh in on. We need to make sure that our concerns are addressed, and it needs to happen right now.
Senator Hoon-Young Hopgood serves Michigan's 8th Senatorial District. Senator, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership.